seated. Good afternoon. Back on the record in Johnson versus Wisconsin Elections Commission. We are at the stage of the proceedings where we are running into the last 2:30 arguments. I see that Mr. Hirsch is poised and ready to begin, and so we will begin with you.
May it please the court. Sam Hirsch for the Citizen Mathematicians and Scientists. I first just want to thank you for taking an incredible amount of time and obviously study and energy to help resolve this extremely important case. I've been practicing in this area for 25 years in front of many state Supreme Courts and have rarely seen an argument as in-depth and thoughtful as this morning, so I'm delighted to be here with all of you. I want to tell you a little bit about my clients and how they drew their maps before we get into the features of those maps. Interestingly, they went almost completely unmentioned, I think, this morning. My clients are five professors from Marquette University and the University of Wisconsin. These men and women are from different academic disciplines. Some are mathematicians, some statisticians, some computer scientists. Obviously, they come from very different institutes of higher learning. I can tell you they come from different ethnic backgrounds. Some have families that have been in this country for generations. Others are relatively recently naturalized. One thing I can't tell you is their political party affiliation, because I don't know. I've never asked, and frankly, I don't care, and neither do they. What they believe in is that the application of science and cutting-edge computational techniques can be helpful to this court in identifying a map that will work best for the common good of all Wisconsinites. They are not here to push an agenda for any political party, any incumbent office holder, or any demographic slice of the electorate. And in that sense, I think they're different from everybody else up here. They are here, of course, not to increase the political power of mathematicians. That's not what they're about. Rather, they believe that by drawing thousands or millions of maps and choosing the ones that most fully comply with your instructions from the November 30th order, they can have a major public service. And I applaud them for that, and I hope you will too. What did they take away from your November 30th order? They saw that you set a hierarchy that applies to all three maps, although it applies a bit differently to the congressional map, as we'll discuss later, because the Wisconsin Constitution speaks in direct ways to the legislative maps, but not the congressional. But the hierarchy is the same. Number one is population equality. That's the whole reason we're here. If population growth in Wisconsin had been perfectly even over the last decade, there would be no malapportionment claims, but of course that's not the case. That is number one. Number two is complying with all the state and federal legal requirements, and the list is different for congressional versus legislative. Number three is the least change approach. And then fourth, there's at least a possibility of resorting to traditional neutral redistricting criteria if maps are effectively tied on those first three items in the hierarchy. So let's talk about the state requirements as to legislative number one, and easily the most important, is population equality. There were questions this morning from Justice Hagedorn and others about how precisely that command should be taken. The plain text speaks about redistricting according to the number of inhabitants, but this court's precedents are much more specific than that. As Justice Bradley pointed out repeatedly, the Cunningham opinion, the Attorney General versus Cunningham opinion from 1882, said that there should be as close an approximation to exactness as possible. It also said that that provision is mandatory and imperative, not subject to discretion. And it said that districts must be as nearly equal in population as other constitutional requirements will permit. And that was repeated 6 months later in Lamb versus Cunningham by this court, where maps were invalidated. And the court said, it is impossible to secure exact and equal representation by reason of the constitutional hindrances in Section 4, And it is because of such hindrances and only because of such hindrances that the legislature under the Constitution, that the legislature under the Constitution is at liberty to depart from the equality, meaning that the only reason not to seek perfect population equality is if it is prevented by complying with other constitutional provisions. And then more recently in 1964, this court, after the U.S. Supreme Court handed down Baker versus Carr, spoke of a precise standard of apportionment and said that mathematical equality was the command, subject only to two things: one, practical limitations in execution of this principle, and two, precise constitutional restrictions about observance of governmental boundaries in drawing district lines. That's a quote from the Zimmerman case, 1964. What's interesting is there is one set of maps that do best on both of these things, on population equality and on respect for counties, which is the foremost of those geographic limitations. And those are the maps produced by the citizen mathematicians and scientists. They have the best population equality, both chambers of the state legislature, and in the Senate, they split only 28 counties, whereas everybody else splits 42 to 48. 28 versus something in the 40s. It's a significant difference. And in the Assembly, similarly, they split 40 counties as opposed to 50-some-odd in all of the competing maps. So it's not as if there's a trade-off to be had here between better population equality and better integrity of counties. You can have both. They're in the same maps. And not coincidentally, they were the ones drawn by computer scientists and mathematicians experts after running hundreds of thousands, I believe millions, of possible maps through their algorithms.
So, but when I look at your maps, you move more than 1 million people more than the legislature, who move more than 100,000 people more than the governor. So as far as least change, I think you might have the most change out of the maps that were submitted here.
We do have the most change out of the legislative maps, not the congressional. We'll get to that in a moment. But on the legislative side, Your Honor, you are exactly right. But that is precisely because we are complying with the state constitution's plain text and this court's precedents interpreting it.
And it seems to me that you have, I don't know if disregarded is too strong a word, and I don't mean it to be too strong. Or maybe it's after lunch and I just can't think of a better word. So I'm gonna go with it. It seems to me that you've disregarded the VRA in your analysis. And so I'd like you to speak to that if you would.
Sure. So on the Senate side, there's no distinction among the maps being presented. They all have two effective black districts and one. The issue I assume you're raising, Your Honor, is on the Assembly side, and again, there's no difference on the Latino, as to Latino voters. As to black voters, I have to say, as someone that's practiced in this area for a very long time, I was a little bit shaken this morning by the extreme level of race consciousness in the discussions. Let me be clear about what the U.S. Supreme Court has said in this area. It is proper to consider race and racial data in redistricting, number one. Number two, it is proper to intentionally create minority districts. There have always been some justices on the Supreme Court who said otherwise. They've never held a majority. But it is important not to use race and racial data excessively and without justification. That is the Shaw doctrine, the anti-racial gerrymandering doctrine. So what we see here, and in a series of cases involving, including Alabama Legislative Black Caucus, Bethune-Hill, Harris, and going all the way back to Bush v. Vera in the 1990s, the Supreme Court has been very skeptical of plans that seem to be targeting, inching up over the 50% line just for the sake of saying we have a majority black district. That is not the right way to protect minority voting rights. And I think you see that in quite a few of the maps being discussed here. So
what's your evidence of that? Because when I look at the Black's submissions, they reach a different conclusion than you do, and they say that when we do create the seventh district, that with their analysis, that that would allow a black candidate to do well in that 7th district. So what's the evidence that you're coming up with that runs counter to that?
So I don't contest that they have 7 effective black assembly districts in their plan, and so do we. But we did so in a way that was organic and respectful of the state constitution. They, as well as the Hunter and governor's plans, spill 2 of their 7 districts over the line to the north into Ozaukee County, to the west into Waukesha, and basically fill them with 40-something percent of effectively what are white, in the business they call these white filler people, people who are certain to lose the election because they're being put into majority black districts to pad them. We, on the other hand, kept of all 7 of our districts, and we have 7, in Milwaukee County, and at the same time, we had 4 that are solely in the city of Milwaukee, whereas everybody else has 1 or 2. We broke 0 wards. Everybody else broke 6 to 8 or more. We followed the communities of interest that the Governor's People's Maps Commission identified in northern Milwaukee County to a far greater extent than they did. Now, ours vary in demographics enormously. A couple of them are in the 30-something percent range, like 35%, 38%. One of them is over 80%, and you heard a lot of oohs and ahs this morning about, well, wouldn't that be packing? Well, it's not packing, first of all, because we create 7 districts that nominate and elect the same black preferred candidates by and large, not every single time, but by and large, as any of the other plans do. And we know that because we didn't cherry-pick the elections. We checked, Justice Rogensack, we checked every statewide election in the last decade and every contested primary in the last decade. And that's the basis on which we concluded that our 7 districts, every one of them individually, is likely, overwhelmingly likely, to both nominate and elect black preferred candidates. Moreover, why we have an 80-plus percent black district is because there is a 60,000-person set of neighborhoods in Milwaukee that happen to be 80-plus percent black. And we didn't gerrymander them to try to get around that. We just accepted it as a fact of the realities of housing in Milwaukee. Now, you could say, well, are your districts that are 35% or 38% black actually effective? The answer is absolutely yes, because we checked them against all those elections I just named. And also, I remind you that Congressional District 4, as it currently exists and is represented by Congresswoman Gwen Moore, is only 31% black. Nobody doubts that that's an effective district for black voters.
She wins by 78%.
Exactly. Right. So that's an effective district. So that raises the question that Justice Hagedorn raised over and over this morning, which is, well, are we in VRA land at all? And the answer is yes, but here's why. People have not, I think, correctly explained that third prong of Jingles. The way you analyze this is you look at what would happen in an all-black district and in an all-non-black district. Not that one could be drawn, but that's analytically what you're doing. And if you find that you're in a part of the country where it doesn't matter because blacks and non-blacks are electing or nominating the same candidates, then the Voting Rights Act falls out of the picture entirely. Mm-hmm. But if black and non-black voters, either in the general election or in the relevant primary, or both, prefer different voters, then the Voting Rights Act is there to say, well, are all the racial groups, not just blacks, also Latinos, also whites, getting a fair share? And the rough rule of thumb for fair share is you look statewide, this is in the LULAC case by the Supreme Court, you look statewide at the citizen voting age population. The best approximation for what that means for African Americans in Wisconsin is they should have 7 districts. Are they absolutely required? Maybe, maybe not. But why would you want to take the risk of going forward with a plan that only has 6 districts and setting up plaintiffs who could then sue and demand 7? On the other hand, why would you go forward with a map that has 7 districts that are all between 50 and 51% black? And obviously we're driven by a search for arbitrary mechanical demographic targets, because that's setting yourself up for a 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause suit in federal court.
You know,
that's not a good idea.
Talking about the VRA, and you did a survey of all of the elections, which I commend you on because I think that's what you should have done. Is there a prima facie case that the 3 Jingles factors have been met here? I have a problem with the 3rd factor, basically because Milwaukee is very capable of electing black representatives at every level of state government and federal government, and I haven't seen it. So if you could explain that to me, that would help me a ton.
Yes, Your Honor. So we use the industry standard, the best method, which is called ecological inference, to compare the demographics of precincts with their voting behavior. And we found in the Milwaukee area that the candidates preferred by black voters and the candidates preferred by non-black voters usually are different. So if you have a district that has too small a black percentage, it will cause the black preferred candidates to lose, either in the primary or the general, perhaps both. And if you have a district with a high enough black percentage, it is possible for the black preferred candidates to win both the primary and the general and therefore take office. So it's not true that if you drew districts with absolutely no regard to race, that you would likely end up with a fair share for black voters, Latino voters, and white voters in Milwaukee. Therefore, the Voting Rights Act does apply, but not in this extreme, targeted, quota-like fashion of how many 51% districts can we draw. That's not what the law demands.
Okay. What I need you to back up on, because I didn't quite understand you, is how you meet the third factor, which is, as you know, that the white majority has to vote sufficiently, that's the test, as a bloc to enable it to usually defeat the minority preferred candidate. I didn't see anything except the few things that were picked out by the bloc's expert that showed that. So, and you're telling me you use ecological eminence rather than actual contests?
No, we use ecological inference, which is a technique, just to identify who is preferred by black voters and who is preferred by other voters. And it turns out there are districts that can be drawn in Milwaukee County that will routinely, the vast majority of time, defeat black preferred candidates. So you can't just assume That's the third prong of Jingles,
yeah.
Your Honor.
Yeah.
We know that you can draw districts that will routinely and consistently defeat black preferred candidates in the primary or in the general or in both in the Milwaukee area. And for that reason, the Voting Rights Act does kick in, and that's why the third prong of Jingles is also satisfied, because if you drew districts the wrong way, then the non-black majority would usually defeat the black preferred candidates.
Right, but you're talking about hypothetical districts, and we told people to do least change, which should at least start them with the districts Milwaukee had in 11, wouldn't it?
We totally accept and agree with your least change approach, but it's not a legal requirement the way the Voting Rights Act is. The legal requirements here deal with population equality, the Voting Rights Act, respect for counties, towns, wards, and I want to get back to wards, that's important, as well as compactness as much as is practicable. Those are legal requirements. Least change is not about whether to comply with those things. It's about how to comply with those things.
I agree with all of what you said. I'm still having a little trouble understanding your answer to my question, but I'll read it over in the morning probably.
It's been a long day for all of us, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. So, Counsel, I just want to ask a follow-up question to that. So you agree we're in VRA land. But you have difficulty with the way some of the other folks have gone about drawing these districts. How are we supposed to figure that out? I mean, how are we supposed to know that, 60, 40, 50, 51, 55, 45? I mean, how are we supposed to figure out at what stage we've crossed some line? I feel like we're hugging a water balloon here.
Yeah, so here's what we did. We looked at actual election returns. So as the computer was redrawing districts, and it does this many times a second, it was actually doing all the analysis I'm about to describe. It was looking at any two new districts in the Milwaukee area, and it was saying, do they consistently elect in the general elections the black preferred candidate? All seven of our elections hit the mark 15 times out of 15, all the statewide elections in the last decade. But it didn't stop there, because all that would do is say it's a Democratic district. Then there's a question of, well, can a black preferred candidate actually win the nomination in the Democratic primary? So it was analyzing those 10 statewide primaries. It had already determined, using ecological inference, which candidate in each of those 10 primaries was black preferred, and it was seeing if they did well. And in all of our districts, Mr. Barnes got 80-plus percent of the vote. And in all of our districts, Malon Mitchell, who was getting crushed statewide, right? He got 16% of the vote. Someone said 12% earlier. It was 16. But he lost 42-16 to now Governor Evers. He was carrying all seven of our districts. So even as that weak of a statewide candidate, he was heavily black preferred, and he was winning all seven of our districts. If you see that, then you're in Cooper versus Harris land, which is don't keep adding black population to creep up over the 50% threshold. You've already got effective districts. Everybody has six districts. Everybody, I think, has six districts. By the way, people saying the legislature only has five, I don't think that's true. That sixth district is perfectly effective. But everybody has the same six, which are nested in Senate districts 6 and 4. What we have is a seventh district that is Assembly District 7, and it's nested in Senate District 3. And it's 41% black. It went Democratic, black preferred, in 15 out of 15 general elections. It voted for Barnes 88%. And it voted for Mitchell over Evers by a more than 2-to-1 margin. That's our seventh district.
So
that's perfectly fine.
When you say you looked at all these elections, I'm looking at your data right now, you looked at statewide elections, and really only two of those had a black candidate, correct?
Three of them had black candidates. I believe in 2012 there was an attorney general candidate who was black. But the ones that we thought were most probative were the three most recent elections, and especially the Barnes and Mitchell elections candidates.
So really just statewide, and you really focused on the Barnes and Mitchell elections statewide, lieutenant governor and governor.
That's correct, but I can tell you that the algorithm actually looked at all 10, and it concluded that all seven of our districts were more than 80% likely to perform.
Where is that in the record?
It is not.
And part of what I think is really important is that we all focus on the record of what's in front of us, because I could go back to my office and look up elections on my own, right? So what you've got in here is you've got the focus, and it's a pretty short, it's just page 8, a couple paragraphs on these elections, but you're saying based on these numbers, basically mostly of Malon Mitchell and of Mandela Barnes, that's how you reach your numbers.
Yes, and Your Honor, all of our districts have higher black voting age population percentages and higher black citizen voting age population percentages than the current Congressional District 4, which is Gwen Moore's district. I assure you these are all effective districts. There are some maps that have six, including Senator Bewley's and the legislature. Ours and all the others have seven. They all work. You don't need perfection. There is a great line in a Supreme Court case that's been repeated now in like half a dozen different cases, saying that minority voters also have a responsibility to pull, haul, and trade to win elections.
Can you explain to me then, given that premise, how you justify AD 11 being over 80%?
The only possible problem with that, first of all, that district is quite a neighborhood-based district. It actually makes sense on the ground, and it doesn't, unlike a lot of other maps being discussed here, it doesn't crawl over the Waukesha County line or the Ozaukee County line. It respects county and municipal boundaries. But the only reason you would ever need to unpack it is if you were trying to create an eighth effective district. And we don't think there's any legal claim that eight are required. And in fact, it would be slightly super proportional to do so. So as long as that's not a problem, why not just respect natural neighborhoods, respect municipalities and counties, and just have minority districts that are organic and have different BVAP percentages? There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, it's much more consistent with what the Supreme Court's been telling us about not being overly race conscious in redistricting.
Does that play into your argument? I wanted to bring you back to it because you said wards are very important.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. The plain text of our Constitution says that assembly districts shall, quote, be bounded by county, precinct, town, or ward lines. There's only two sets of legislative maps before you that don't break wards, ours and the legislature's. Everybody else's breaks wards, and they're not breaking them along town or county lines. They're just breaking them. They are plainly in violation of the plain text of our Constitution. You have to follow the law here. And as between the legislature's map and ours, there's no comparison in terms of compliance with county lines. We in the Senate break 28 counties into 86 pieces. They break 42 into 115 pieces. In the Assembly, we break 40 counties into 175 pieces. They break 53 into 212 pieces. These are not tiny differences. They're quite large.
When you first started speaking, I wrote down the word trade-off. I think that's kind of an important word here for what you're telling us, because in order to do what you did, which is not break these lines, make sure that there's population equality, not, you know, all the things we've been talking about, you sacrifice moving the most amount of people.
Because that's not a legal requirement. There's a hierarchy.
I understand.
Population. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, I totally get it. I get it. I hear you, but you agree. And so if
Absolutely.
Someone else took least change to mean moving the least amount of people, that was a trade-off that they made. But your trade-off was to follow these other things first. And you told us the order, and you put least change third, but really did sacrifice it in terms of the vast amount of people that you moved.
Yes and no. We did this really interesting test, which we said, how many miles of our boundaries are following either the 2011 law's boundaries or a county line? And when you do that, we come out really well. Because when we deviated from the 2011 maps, we did it to get back in line with the state constitution.
If you were trying to do least change, though, in terms of moving people, you wouldn't have been able to do what you did. Would you agree?
Yes, we put a higher priority on compliance with the state constitution than on least change. Because although we believe least change is a very good way for this court to do its task in a modest and restrained way, it cannot take precedence over the plain text of the Wisconsin Constitution or of this court's repeated precedents interpreting that constitution in 1892 and as recently as 1964.
Counsel, let's say I agree with you that the priority or hierarchy of considerations. Your counsel right before our break over the lunch hour said, hey, the playing field is changing. The order that you issued, the court issued, on November 30th set the least change. There seems to be some agreement that core retention is reflective of least change, or at least an ingredient in some of the briefs. So I hear from several counsel, if we knew that least change was not our lodestar, we would have done something differently. I looked at the November 30th order, and I see that we reference least change in the majority opinion 11 times, and 2 times in the concurrence. Population equality was mentioned not at all in the concurrence, and 3 times in the majority. I think I am in agreement that our order talked about least change. And so what do we do here now when we have actors, players, participants that say, hey, we followed your November 30th directive. I mean, you have probably the worst score in core retention, because that was not your hierarchy, right?
It's not your hierarchy, Your Honor.
It should not be our hierarchy. That's what you're saying. But look at our November 30th order.
Yes, we're
core retention isn't mentioned anywhere in the majority order, is it?
Right.
I think that's right. I think that's right.
Let me get further that then. In reading the briefs, it seemed like a number of the parties were equating least change. One of the best indicators of least change is core retention. Do you agree or disagree with that?
I don't think it's that simple. The dissent asked the majority, please tell us precisely how to measure least change. And the majority wisely said, no, there's one, implicitly, the way I read it, they were saying there's not one metric. And we, in fact, have several. And a good example of this is if you look at the congressional map, the legislature's congressional map is best on that core retention number, but it's worst on every other least change metric that's in the record.
So you would disagree with any party who had in their brief the assertion that instrumental to a determination of least change is a consideration of core retention. You would disagree with any party that had that.
I think core retention is one part of least change, but there's also how much are you moving the lines? How much are you moving area? How much are you busting communities that weren't busted before?
To define least change as core retention is to define our opinion differently than the words in it. I mean, that is not what the opinion said. The opinion said least change. It did not say least change as defined by core retention.
That's correct. And you know what's interesting?
Least change is defined by equality population. No, it doesn't say that either.
No, but equality of population has got to be the foremost goal in remedying a malapportionment claim.
I don't necessarily disagree with some of the propositions that you're advancing, that the Constitution and the law trumps least change. I agree with that. The majority may not, but I do. I understand that. Kind of sympathizing with those who think that the playing field has changed and who have overtly said an argument here today, had they known that least change was not the driving force, they would have drawn maps differently. Well,
Your Honor, my red light is on.
I don't think that was a question, but if you wish to interpret it as a question and answer it, you may.
I will try to do so in one sentence, Your Honor. Thank you. The November 30th order was sufficiently clear that a group of computer programmers, mathematicians, and statisticians could take your legal commands, put them into an algorithm, and beat every one of these maps up, down, and sideways. So it was sufficiently clear, but we're the only people who followed it. Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney Saitlin.
Misha Zaitlin from the Congressman. There are a lot of hard questions before this court today. Luckily, with the congressional lines, the issues here are easy. There are only 8 congressional lines, only 4 proposed maps. 3 of those maps are either obviously illegal, completely unexplained in many of their changes, or both. Only our proposed map is legal, explains every change, and there's only a developed objection to one of the lines in our map. So this court should either entirely adopt our map or ask the parties to propose alternatives to the only line that they objected to. Now, before I begin, I would just like to take a minute to sum up a really important point that I really want to convey to this court. And this relates to the question that Justice Bradley was just asking my friend. It is simply not true that the governor and the Hunter petitioners took this court's least change instructions the way they're telling the court. For if they had, their number of people moved would be in the 3-4%. What they did, cynically, was they looked at the number of changes that we had proposed, and I'll explain to Your Honors in a second why we did that. The governor went a little bit below it, and then the governor made a series of gratuitous changes to District 1 that have absolutely nothing to do with population equality, absolutely nothing to do with it, have nothing to do with communities of interest, and they didn't say a word of it otherwise. They have nothing to do with county splits. They are entirely gratuitous. Redistricting is not a game, Your Honors, the map that this court adopts will be this court's map. It will not be the Hunter's map, and it will not be the governor's map. This court absolutely cannot adopt any map, key features of which were not explained to this court. Not explained to this court after a Wisconsin law expert said, this line doesn't make sense. This line doesn't make sense. This line doesn't make sense. If you look at the governor's reply brief, not a single word on any of those lines. I have a little demonstrative there. Every line that we criticized of the governor's map is there in a color. They're all around District 1. They are not able to give this court, and we're unwilling to give this court, a single word of explanation about any of their changes on that map, and I will talk about that in a second. Now let me say what we thought this court's order meant and why we did what we did.
Counsel, yeah. Hunter indicates with regard to your congressional map that you moved 238,929 people out of the third CD. Is that correct?
That number does sound correct, Your Honor.
In contrast, Hunter averts that they moved 983 out of the CD and 4,645 into the CD. So about 5,500 compared to the movement of 238,929. That sounds like a lot of movement. I'm from the CD. When you move that many people, there are not that many people.
Well, Your Honor, let me explain why we did what we did.
That sounds like awfully glad. Yes.
Exactly. Your Honor, let me explain why we did what we did, and then I will respectfully give you honors what I think are your choices about that. But we understood this court's least changes instructions in both the lead opinion and Justice Higginbotham's concurrence is to explain every change from the existing map while paying due respect to things like communities of interest and traditional district criteria and county lines. Every single opinion cited by the lead opinion that adopted least changes did that approach. Mm-hmm. Justice Hagedorn was very explicit about that in his opinion. And so what we did is, what happened is that District 2 is wildly overpopulated. That population needs to go somewhere. We made the sensible decision, which we explained, to send that population to District 3 because there was a rural portion of District 2 that made sense in District 3 from the point of view of Wisconsin's community of interests. Once that happened, District 3 was very overpopulated, and it needed to change. And so with this big overpopulation in District 3, an underpopulated District 7, and a series of county splits that we could fix, and communities of interest that we could unite, that's what we did. Now, it is true, Your Honors, that it is possible to move less people from 3 to 7.
5,500 versus 238,000, that's a big number.
Your Honor, 5,500 is not possible if you move the District 2 people into District 3. That's because they did something else with the District 2 people, which we can discuss later. But
what about your splits in municipalities? Hunter says that your map splits more municipalities than any other maps. That's at their reply at page 3. Is that correct?
That is absolutely false. According to the nonpartisan Legislative Reference Bureau, we split 16 municipalities. The governor splits 25. We split 10 counties. The governor splits 12. Their expert has some different number. That expert's number seems entirely inconsistent with what the Legislative Reference Bureau told us, and inconsistent with generally what the citizen mathematician expert said as well. So I think their expert is just wrong on that. But I think it's more important, Your Honors, in doing the least changes methodology, is to look at each individual proposed change and see if that makes sense. Because, of course, not all municipalities are created equal. You know, there's small ones, there's big ones. And so take a look at the explanations. Unfortunately, with that, only our map is explained to this court.
So it's the best explained change, not the least change? I'm not understanding why. And I'm still not understanding why you moved all of Portage County when 7 was pretty close. So you're trying to say to us that because you explained it in a way that you think is persuasive, that satisfies least change.
This court can select from four maps, or it can request that one of the maps be modified with all input from the court. Three of the maps, two of the maps are plainly illegal. The governor's map and the hunter's map is just illegal. They don't achieve exact population equality. They had a chance to fix that. They didn't. The citizen mathematician map moves lots of people everywhere, doesn't explain. We explain every single change.
Go back to my question.
Yes.
You're saying explaining is the key.
Yes. Well, no. As I said up front, it is your map. It is not our map. It's not the governor's map. It's not the hunter's map. It's your map. If you like all of our explanations, you agree with them, please adopt our map. If you don't like our explanation for line 3 and 7, and I'm hearing a little skepticism, and I heard some skepticism from my friends, then this court should say, the legislative, the congressional map is good. It makes all the right changes. But there's a problem with 3 and 7. Everyone submit their proposed alterations to 3 and 7. We think our line between 3 and 7 makes perfect sense. This court should adopt it. But this court is going to have to adopt the map at the end of the day. The other three maps are entirely disqualified. So unless your honors are just going to go with our map, because...
What's the case that says that they're disqualified?
Well,
the case that says going one up or one down is not exact in a different way than going one down. I mean, what's the case? Please point it to me.
The U.S. Supreme Court in 2006 in Inouye v. Abbott says, quote, states must draw congressional districts with populations as close to perfect equality as possible.
And how has that been interpreted in the past? In a way that says that you can't have one up in some and one down in some? I've never seen anything like that, Mr. Zaitlin, in any case anywhere that maps have been argued across the country.
And I suppose that you're saying that that's a de minimis difference, right, Your Honor?
That is what the... I'm not saying it. I'm saying the federal courts have said it, and I've yet to see a case. And please, I would love to find a case
Let me read you another passage from the U.S. Supreme Court. Karcher versus Daggett. Quote, no de minimis population variations, which could be practically avoided, but nevertheless meet the standards of Article 1, Section 2, without justification are permissible. Even de minimis ones are not allowed. And, I mean, I guess 2 is de minimis, but that's not allowed. The U.S. Supreme Court says so. And the only time...
What's the site?
The site is 462 U.S. 725 734. And so what there have been some courts that have approved small number of people changes in congressional districts. And all of those courts always say, we've been given a special reason based upon the state's special circumstances why it can't get to one population equality. The governor did not give your honors the special reason. The governor didn't give your honors any explanation at all for many of his changes. And I'd like to a minute to talk about that. The most egregious aspect of what the governor did, and the citizen mathematicians do the same thing, is they pull three communities that are currently in District 4, that is St. Francis, Cudahy, and South Milwaukee, from District 4 into District 1. Now, let me explain why that is entirely indefensible. And no matter what this court does, this court cannot adopt any map that has that feature. District 4 is wildly underpopulated. It is one of the two key features of the problem that's going on here. There is no justification at all possible to pull sizable communities out of District 4 and into another district. What we're doing here is we need to repopulate District 4 and depopulate District 2 to pull significant communities out of District 4 and into District 1 with no explanation. No explanation in terms of communities of interest. We have an unrebutted expert report that says communities of interest, they fit better with 4 than 1. No explanation on county lines, no explanation at all. It is a gratuitous change having nothing to do with lease changes. That disqualifies right there the governor map and the citizen mathematician
map. Mr. Zaitlin, this is how your argument is landing with me. Is I'm hearing you talk about the problems with the governor's map and with those two districts. And then I'm hearing you talk about your map and looking at District 3 and District 7, and you're saying, yeah, we shouldn't have drawn that line where we did, so don't look over here. You can redraw it differently. I don't understand how you could say that their maps are illegal because they don't give a reason for it when your maps displace 200, I think it's like close to 240,000 people out of District 3, even though District 3 was less than 4,000 people under the ideal population. So I feel like you're making like one no, like there's
Your Honor,
different standards for the congressmen than there
Your Honor,
the legislature.
That's really not true. We explained why we did it. We said that the three needed to gain a sizable from two. And then we said we eliminated a bunch of county splits, and we united Stevens Point and Wausau. Now, the court can accept that or not. And if the court rejects that, then I would suggest that the court should ask all the parties to redraw the line. We think that's a good explanation. The fundamental difference is the governor gives No explanation at all. Not a single word of explanation for the change that I discussed. I was looking forward, after I saw your excellent colloquy with the council for the legislature, for you to ask the governor's council the same kind of question about that line. Well, what the heck is going on here? Why are a sizable number of people from these clearly Milwaukee communities, South Milwaukee, leaving the Milwaukee district and going District 1 and see what the governor says? We tried to do that in our brief. We had an expert say this makes absolutely no sense. This is nonsense. And Johnson petitioners said we'd like to see. We expect the governor will offer an explanation for this in deciding between our two maps. The reply brief of the governor, silent. Not a word on this. Not an expert report. No nothing. There is no explanation at all, whether you like it or you might like our explanation on 7 and 3, you might not, I hope that you do. There is no explanation on that change, and therefore this court just can't accept that map. That map is disqualified for lack of explanation.
It's not that I don't like your explanation, I understand it. It's just when the call is for least change and you move almost 250,000 people out of one district into another, I understand why. It just seems like a large number of people to move out if you are trying to follow the least change rule that we set forth in that November 30th order.
We had a lot of people to move out of District 2. We moved into District 3. That made District 3 very overpopulated. And then we cleaned up some county splits. If your honors don't like that, it is your map. You have four maps that are presented to you. I respectfully submit that three of them are essentially useless to the court. Our map seems to have one problem that troubles some of the justices of this court. Either the court can adopt our map or it can ask the parties if they propose an alternative to that one line that we drew that seems to be landing wrongly with Your Honor.
I mean, let me ask you this then, because you just brought this up. Help me understand how moving people in and out of the 3rd and 7th congressional district helps with malapportionment in the 2nd and the 4th. With the second being overpopulated and the fourth being underpopulated.
So we moved people out of two into three to equalize the population of two. So I hope the court is with me there. That makes three very overpopulated. We then could have moved the minimum people from three to seven, which would have divided a lot of communities of interest and divided a lot of counties and kept county splits. So we decided to clean up those lines. But that was in the service of equalizing population. The fundamental difference from what we did and what the governor did is he moves people for no reason, not in service of equalizing population, but for a reason that his lawyers aren't willing to stand up in court and tell you why they're doing it. And it's not just the change that I talked about. You just referenced moving people in and out of districts. And you can see it on the blue line there, which is the line between 1 and 5. The governor moves a large number of people out of 5 and into 1, and a different large number of people out of 1 and into 5. Both those districts are underpopulated. Our expert looked at this and said, this doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense in terms of equalizing population. It doesn't make sense in terms of communities of interest. We expected my friend, the governor's expert, to explain why. They didn't. Complete silence.
And your explanation wouldn't have anything to do with the fact that taking Stephen's point out makes District 3 more competitive for your clients. I go back to what Justice Hagedorn said, and if anyone here thinks that there's not a political motive behind the legislature drawing maps, they're crazy. That's what the legislature does.
Your Honor, I have no clients in District 3. If you want to change District 3 in a different way, like the one in the rejected map we submitted, we are perfectly happy with that. We tried to do our best for the court. We thought that line made sense. We don't have a vested interest in the line. We frankly don't really care about it.
Then what's wrong with the rest of the maps?
What's wrong with the rest of the maps is that whole outline around District 1. They have fundamentally changed one of the 8 districts of the state for no reason they're willing to tell this court. It is a remarkable thing in a redistricting litigation to have a map submitted to the court, to have your expert criticize that map, specific lines based on communities of interest, and have the other side say, absolutely nothing to explain those criticisms. And I think the reason that they can't explain it is there is no explanation that they can put down on a piece of paper.
I doubt they did something without an explanation. Maybe they haven't explained it to you, or perhaps not to the court, but it's rare that this kind of an action moves forward with no reason behind it. I'm going to shift your argument a little bit. I'm very interested in, obviously, the Voter Rights Act applies. I'm very interested in when there's been a violation or not, and I've asked a lot of parties about that. My question to you is the same as to the others. Do you believe that the three Gingles or Gingras factors, G-I-N-G-L-E-S factors, have been met? I'm most concerned with the third, but I'd like to hear what your position is on whether all three have been met.
With regard to the congressional districts,
yes,
it's only District 1. It's pretty clear that the third factor is not met, but there is no dispute here with regard to the VRA because everyone left District 4 alone. But yes, I do think the third factor with regard to District 4 would not be met. The preferred candidate of choice of African-American voters is not being...
District 4 or 1?
District 4. That's the only one.
It's a congressional district.
Congressional. We're not talking about congressional. But there's been no... And there's no real meeting of any sort of dispute on VRA with regard to Congress because there is just District 4 and it's performing just fine. You know, Congressman Moore continues to win significantly, and I assume she will until she chooses not to run again. So I think that's my answer to your question. It doesn't really bear on the dispute.
Okay, so it's not been met because there's just been no showing that the white voters are voting as a black to defeat the black candidate.
That's right. If someone had tried to destroy District 4, I don't think that would have been a VRA violation. But it's not relevant because District 4 is a fine district the way it is for communities of interest reason and continuity reasons. And the only thing we did with District 4 is that we equalized this population. What the governor and the citizen mathematicians did with District 4 is they took significant populations out of the most underpopulated district, Milwaukee communities, and moved them into District 1. Obviously, that's not for no reason, Your Honor. Everyone in the courtroom knows the reason for that. We're not supposed to talk about that. That's fine. But every change that they want this court to make, they have to be willing to explain. They are not willing to explain why they are taking those Milwaukee communities out of the Milwaukee district and putting them in District 1.
Counsel, there's a difference between offering an explanation and offering a forthright explanation. And I have grave concerns about your justification of trying to move Stevens Point from the third into the seventh. Because you and I know what's really going on, and it has very little to do with forest product industry or community of interest. If you want community of interest, Wisconsin Rapids is half the distance from Wausau, right?
Your Honor, I was being very forthright. My clients don't care about District 3. We don't care about District 3 one way or the other. We don't run in those districts. If this court does not like that line, does not like that move to Stevens Point, I would urge this court to order all the parties to propose their amendment to the only viable map before this court, which is ours.
Hunter says that your map doesn't comply, if I recall, correct me if I'm wrong on this, with the Voting Rights Act.
No, Your Honor. There's no dispute that our map complies with the Voting Rights Act. There's no dispute that our map complies with the Equal Protection Clause. There's no dispute that our map is equal populace.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. Recollection was problematic. They say at page, I think, 11 of their reply brief that this. They say that your... the congressman's proposed map reduced county splits in a manner that blatantly violates the court's least change mandate. That's what I was referring to in their reply brief at 11. Can you respond to that?
Right. So the only line that they then criticized is the line between 3 and 7. The rest of the lines they leave uncriticized. And we explain our line 3 and 7, Your Honor, does not accept that explanation. I'm sorry to hear that. But we had multiple lines of theirs. We said, where's your explanation? Especially with regard to the changes to District 1. And we had a couple of other objections. They had one explanation for a change between 2 and 6. That's fair enough. But they had no explanation, the Hunter folks, for their massive moving people of back and forth between two underpopulated districts, 5 and 1. They had no explanation for that at all, for this court to like or not like. And so that's why I say that those maps are disqualified. The Hunter map is also disqualified because it's unconstitutional. But even if that wasn't an issue, their map is disqualified because it doesn't help this court. It is not going to be our map, the governor's map, the Hunter map. It's going to be your map. And if there's a line that you cannot explain in your opinion because the party who proposed it hasn't helped you, you simply can't adopt that map.
Council, I have a question on the county and municipal splits. I'm struggling to figure out why any of that's relevant here. I know there is the Wisconsin Constitution speaks to respecting those local lines with regard to state legislative maps, but there's nothing in the Wisconsin Constitution that says anything about congressional redistricting, and therefore we're really, at least with regard to that, operating under federal law, potentially. I know there were some arguments about whether the state constitution somewhere else might, by implication, require something related to that. But anyway, I guess, why should I care about county or municipal splits as a part of this?
Well, Your Honor, as your concurrence correctly points out, consideration of traditional redistricting criteria is part and parcel of a least changes analysis, and always has been.
So it's part of that kind of third thing. If you get past the legal requirements and least change, that's where that would maybe factor in. Is that the reason you would offer it?
That's right. And I think that it's only really important to the extent that those county lines track communities of interest, which they often do because of the importance of counties in Wisconsin government. Really, when you're trying to do least change, you're trying to not disrupt people. And when you split their communities of interest, then you are really disrupting those people. And so counties and municipalities, they can be proxies for that, which is why we don't think that this court needs to sort out the disagreement between Legislative Research Bureau and the way that the Hunter expert does municipalities. Your Honor should look at the maps, look at the explanations, look at which municipalities are split, and what that means for the people of Wisconsin. This is one of the reasons that it was the right decision for this court to take, because these maps are going to be governing the political lives of Wisconsinites for the next decade. The maps that this court adopts have to make sense for the state of Wisconsin within the least changes methodology. When you have three other proposed maps that won't answer our experts' claims that their maps don't make sense for the state of Wisconsin in terms of our communities of interest, that is waiver. That means they have conceded by silence, by failing to meet our Wisconsin law expert with their own Wisconsin law expert, that their maps make no sense for the state of Wisconsin.
Not a trial. So in that sense, I don't think that you can say because they didn't meet your expert with an expert of their own. I mean, this case we could have this all again once a week if we adopted that as our format. So I don't think that you can say that they've waived a challenge to what you're saying because of that.
I mean, that's fair enough, Your Honor. And I suppose that if in their brief they said, well, we don't have an expert that says why it makes sense to move South Milwaukee communities out of the Milwaukee district, and their lawyer said, West Milwaukee really has more in common with District 1, and they're willing to sign that kind of brief, then maybe this court can consider that without an expert proffer. I think there's a reason they didn't do that. I think that a lawyer wouldn't sign that kind of brief because that doesn't make any sense.
So it doesn't make any sense to put Janesville and Beloit together. It doesn't make any sense to put all of Waukesha together. It doesn't make sense to put southern Milwaukee counties with Racine, in which they may have a lot in common with. None of that makes sense to you, but it does make sense, in, according to what we're supposed to accept from you, to move Stevens Point. Just take it out.
As I've said, Your Honor, we made our best effort on Stevens Point. If Your Honors reject that change, we wouldn't have any sort of sweat about that. With regard to those other lines, we gave specific explanations of why their lines did not make sense. They did not meet us. They did not explain why those lines make sense, why they make sense with response to Wisconsin communities of interest. As a result, for failure to explain, I mean, Your Honors, I suppose, could fill in the blanks for them. Your Honors could write an opinion that says, yeah, it really does make sense that Milwaukee counties are going to be in District 1. Your Honors could write that opinion. I think that wouldn't write very well, however, in my respectful submission, which is, I think, why the governor's map and the citizen map petition map are completely out for that change alone. All three maps are out for failure to explain, and the governor and the Hunter are out for unconstitutionality. And I will sit down early.
Let me just clarify. My home territory. Do I hear you withdrawing the request to put Stevens Point into the seventh?
No.
Our position is that we think that that is a better move, but we do not mind at all if Your Honor rejects that.
Yes,
we don't have any particular dog in the fight between what happens in District 3 and 7. We did our best to help the court. We're concerned about the districts where our candidates run. And so we presented that alternative map for this court's consideration. And I understand this court rejected that because it would be unfair to have us present two maps where everyone presented one. But if Your Honors are unhappy about that Stevens Point change...
No, I'm unhappy with your explanation. That's what I'm unhappy with. And then you take people to task for not offering explanations. Quite frankly, I would prefer a forthright explanation less than no explanation. Stated otherwise, I would rather people not explain than explain in a way that really isn't being forthright to the court. That's my concern.
If Your Honor wouldn't cite an opinion that said Stevens Point makes more sense with Wausau, and I think it does make more sense with Wausau, but if Your Honor doesn't want to sign that, but otherwise agrees with everything else I've said and wants to not have any unfairness, then the court should say, hey, parties, we're happy with the congressman's map, but this Stevens Point change is not something we're happy with. Please propose an alternative line between 3 and 7 on the congressman's map, and we wouldn't lose a sweat. We stand by, and I think, and our expert says, and I think most people in Wisconsin think that Stevens Point has more in common with Wausau.
Well, they also know that the 7th purple, right? And then now it's more red in percentage than in the others. And so let's take good old Democratic Stevens Point. It's so blatantly political that it is problematic for you.
And I don't want to repeat myself, Your Honor. It would be very easy for the court to solve this issue. Issue an order saying, we don't like that change. We don't want to give the congressman two bites of the apple. Every single party that cares about the congressional maps can submit a new line between 3 and 7 because everything else on our map is undisputed. Every other line we have, nobody is really engaged with. So if that's what you're unhappy with, and that's where I want to circle back. It's your map. It's not our map. I mean, it's going to ultimately be the map of the people. And so the
Mr.
court...
Mr. Salen, I don't think that we don't have problems. I mean, you move the highest number of people. You move the greatest number of people, and maybe that gets remedied with the Stevens Point. I'm not sure what the population of Stevens Point is, but that's the problem with the map. And I think, you know, just to springboard off of what Justice Ann Walsh Bradley said about taking other people to task, including me, for not asking the governor a question, but perhaps the governor's attorney, Mr. Russomano, didn't have the opportunity to answer a question because he is sitting here defending the assembly maps, the Senate maps, and the congressional maps. So,
if I may answer.
You may. Your light's on, though.
Yes. Our map moves the second least number of people. The only map that moves less people than us is the governor's, which is obviously and clearly unconstitutional and also has multiple features that the governor is unwilling to defend before this court. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Well, we've made it through the first round. Now we are back to rebuttal. And you're still with us, Mr. Essenberg? All right, it's your turn. 10 minutes is going to go fast, so.
Yep.
Here we go.
A few points. First of all, our friend from the Hunters Interveners suggests that the Voting Rights Act is no more than a command to create minority opportunity districts when you can, and that no denial of the right to participate in an election is required as long as the jingles factors are present. It's just concerned with results. That's not true. There's only one Voting Rights Act. There's only one Section 2. It prescribes, and we should quote from the statute, denial or abridgment of the right to vote on account of race, color, or membership in a language minority group.
So are you saying, since apparently there was a new argument today that the VRA does not apply, that for the first time the legislator is making, are you saying the VRA applies?
I don't think that on the record that we have before us, a violation of the Voting Rights Act has been established. Now, I think that with respect to the legislative map, the legislature took the position in oral argument today that it didn't take race into account in drawing the lines. We're applying a least changes approach. I think that this court would be well within its rights to affirm those six districts that are created by the legislature.
But why would we do that? If the VRA doesn't apply, why should we be looking at race at all? How can you have it both ways? That's what I'm not understanding.
Well, because we instructed, or this court rather, instructed the parties to adopt a least changes approach. And I think it did adopt a least changes approach, the legislature in Milwaukee. They say that they did not draw these maps on the basis of race. I have no reason to challenge that assertion. And so I don't think that the question of whether or not there has been some type of unconstitutional employment of race with respect to at least the legislature's maps is presented and before the court. But if we're going to create a seventh map, and if we're going to move a bunch of black voters around because we've decided that 50.1% is enough to combat some unexplained abridgment of the right to vote, then we have to have a prima facie case under the Voting Rights Act, and I just don't think that that's present here. It's not present here because the jingles factors are not met. I think our friend from the...
Is it the third jingle factor that isn't met? What about the first two?
It certainly is possible to create a number of minority districts. That would be the first factor. There is evidence that racial groups are cohesive, but there must be racial block voting, which usually defeats the preferred candidate of minority voters. So, and that's simply... I'm sorry. That hasn't been shown here, and I think it hasn't been shown for two reasons. First of all, our friend from the block interveners, I think, made a fatal concession this morning when, in response to a question about some other races that were not highlighted by his experts, said, well, we didn't look at that because there wasn't racial block voting. That's not how you do it. You have to establish that there's racial block voting. You have to look at every race. And even if that was a misstatement, what we come down to support the proposition that racial block voting usually defeats the minority's preferred candidate, the preferred candidate of minority voters, is that the minority preferred candidate lost 4 out of 7 times. I don't think it's fair to characterize that as a usual defeat. When you have an odd number, you have to either be one up or one down. That's as close to 50-50 as you can get.
My question is this, and was this, is it the third factor that you take issue with?
Yes.
And so you're really acknowledging the first two factors are met?
The first factor is whether or not you can create a majority-minority district. You can.
Yeah.
The second factor is if minority voters are politically cohesive. They are. But the third factor is not met because, A, we haven't established racial block voting, and we haven't established racial block voting that, even if we had established it, we haven't established racial block voting that usually defeats the minority's preferred candidate.
Well, is it established for the six districts that we have?
It's not established for the six districts that we have, but with respect to the six districts that we have, it is my understanding that the legislature is asserting that it did not draw those districts on the basis of race. And with respect to a least changes approach, those districts, at least insofar as they are present in the legislative maps, can be left in place without, I think, raising the question of an unconstitutional use of race in the drawing of the districts. So I'm not concerned so much about the six districts, at least as they exist in the legislative maps. I am concerned about the creation of a seventh district without the prima facie showing of a Voting Rights Act violation, both because the jingles factors are not present, and quite frankly, if you look at the totality of circumstances, and you must do both, I think that's why the Hunter interveners are wrong, You must do both, and you look at what is present in the report on the totality of circumstances. You just haven't made out a Voting Rights Act violation.
Analytically, do you get to the Senate factors if the jingle factors are not met?
You said not. You
must do both, but you do not.
The jingles factors are often referred to as preconditions. They must be met before you can go any further, but then you must go further and you must take into account the Senate factors under the totality of circumstances. The other point I wanted to raise just briefly is that there's been this controversy about whether or not population equalization drops out of the case once some safe harbor has been met. I don't think that it would be fair to characterize continued consideration of population equalization as being equivalent to this court playing Lucy, pulling out the football from the party's Charlie Brown, because I think the court made clear that it wanted these maps to be as exact as possible in remedying the very thing that brought this case about, and that is malapportionment. And so,
Counsel, if you had a district that was roughly equivalent but not exactly equivalent to the ideal population, would there arise a cognizable claim there? That it was violating the Wisconsin Constitution?
I think there are two things at work here. First, we know that a federal court will defer to the drawing of state legislative maps and provide some type of safe harbor, and will not do it with respect to the drawing of congressional maps. The question is why. I think the best explanation that has been offered for that is that it is a federalism concern. That is, there is a stronger interest of the federal government in the drawing of maps for the federal legislature. And if that's so, then I think this court would be well within its rights and would be acting consistently with the Wisconsin Constitution to insist upon a higher degree of exactitude in drawing state legislative maps. It would not have the same concerns with respect to deference that federal courts do when they are reviewing maps drawn by state legislators.
So we should give more deference. So our Wisconsin Constitution should be held as imposing a higher standard when it comes to exactness of population than the federal courts have held for congressional maps. Is that what you're saying?
No. The federal courts, with respect to congressional maps, have insisted upon almost perfect population equality.
Right. I misspoke. What they have said with respect to state
maps.
I guess I want to rephrase it. You want us to interpret our Constitution differently than the federal Constitution and impose a different standard under our Constitution. Is that what you're asking?
No, I think I wouldn't put it that way. I think that what I'm suggesting is that a state court ought to treat state legislative maps in the same way as a federal court treats federal legislative maps. And whether or not it
is a higher standard than a federal court treats state maps.
Than a federal court adopts in reviewing state legislative maps, but it's the same or at least similar to what it would do when it's reviewing congressional maps.
So that would be equal or plus.
Nobody would
even be able to get to that standard.
Well, close to equal. I mean, I think this court would have to decide exactly what that means. It might be somewhat more difficult to reach the level of exactitude that we do with congressional maps because of the rules about, splitting counties. But that the point is that I don't think one can assume that the 2% safe harbor applies when a state court is reviewing state legislative maps. The second way that this plays out is that this court has to choose a map. It is not reviewing legislatively enacted maps. It must choose one. And it's quite possible, and perhaps some members of the court believe that there are a number of lawful maps that have been submitted. But the court can't say they're all fine. The court has to choose one. It has to make it the map that will be employed. And it seems to me that using population equality to select a map because one party has done better than the others in eliminating malapportionment would be perfectly within this court's discretion, and I don't think would be violating the November 30th opinion, where the court said that it wanted MAPS to solve this malapportionment as exactly as is possible. And obviously, it is possible to do a better job than some of the MAPS.
Your time's been up for a little bit. I was waiting for the sentence to have a period, and it's not coming, so you're done. Okay, Attorney Packard.
Thank you, Your Honors, and I will try to be louder this time. Counsel for the legislature, as well as for the citizen mathematicians, argued today that population equality is primary, and that the court has directed that it be primary. That is simply incorrect. The court's command was to meet constitutional and statutory requirements while making the least changes to the existing map. The court held that the map chosen can depart from least change only where necessary to avoid a violation of justiciable and cognizable rights protected under the United States Constitution, the Voting Rights Act, and Sections 3, 4, and 5 of Article 4 of the Wisconsin Constitution. The court's command was not to maximize on all constitutional factors.
Well, it's either going to be constitutional or it's not.
And exactly.
Clearly, you did not understand our order to say, do least change and to heck if it's a little unconstitutional. You didn't understand it that way.
I did not understand it to be do least change and, you know, do what you want with the rest.
With
absolutely.
The Constitution and the law, that's primary, right?
We had to make the least changes and not make it unconstitutional and not make it violate the Voting Rights Act. So what we have is a command to avoid unconstitutionality, to avoid violating the Voting Rights Act, and to make least changes. So, for instance, no one claims that the governor's map or Governor Bewley's map is unconstitutional for violating any portion of the Wisconsin Constitution. No one has made the argument.
That was made here today. I have it in my notes.
Well, I don't understand anyone to have said that Senator Bewley's or the governor's map violates Section 3 of Article 4 based on population issues.
I don't think they said based it in on regard to the maps of your clients, but I do think after the governor's maps.
Okay. My point, Your Honors, is that so long as the constitutional and statutory requirements are met, the winning map, so we can have a lot of maps that meet the constitutional and statutory requirements, but the winning map is the map that moves the fewest people and among districts and has the highest core retention. The legislature and the citizen mathematicians flip the court's command, basically. But the court should not be changing its criteria now. A change now would harm the long-term legitimacy of this court and would invite the perception that the court is entering into the political fray to choose winners and losers. That's the problem with the exercise of discretion that people are inviting you to use as well.
Wouldn't it harm the institutional integrity of this court if we did not follow the Constitution we are sworn to uphold?
I agree, which is why none of the maps presented, at least the maps presented by the governor and Senator Bewley, do violate any aspect of the Constitution. No one claims that they do.
Your argument seems to make the remedy for malapportionment kind of secondary to the changes and complying with least changes. But right at the opening of this court's opinion, in paragraph 4, we said this court will remedy that malapportionment. Specifically, the 2011 maps no longer comply with the constitutional requirement of an equal number of citizens in each legislative district due to shifts in population. So we said we will remedy that malapportionment while ensuring that the maps satisfy all other constitutional and statutory requirements. That seems to make malapportionment remedy kind of primary.
Your Honor,
the Wisconsin Constitution commands us.
The way I interpreted that and the way I understand a number of people have interpreted that was that the problem was malapportionment. The solution was making the least changes to the current map and making sure that in making those changes that there were no new constitutional or statutory violations. Now, it's been argued that Article 4, Section 3 requires population equality as close as practicable, right? But that is not what the plain text of the statute, or plain text of the Constitution actually says. It only says apportionment is to be done, quote, according to the number of inhabitants. It does not use the word equal. It does not use the word practicable. So we need to be hewing closely to the constitutional language.
I think that's kind of a strict construction of the constitutional language, which is not something that I personally ascribe to as a judicial philosophy. And our decision said that our decision in Cunningham comports with the provisions original meaning, and that meaning was that there should be as close to an approximation to exactness as possible. And other maps have achieved that.
And this court, as well as precedent in this court, have recognized that the Wisconsin Constitution's population distribution requirements are consistent with federal requirements. That's in paragraphs 8, 25, and 26 of this court's November 30th order. Addressing the constitutionality of Wisconsin maps and the Wisconsin Constitution's requirement of population equality, courts have repeatedly held that 2% deviation is de minimis. We can't maximize on all of the constitutional aspects and have one winner because nobody meets all of those constitutional requirements at the maximum level, as well as making least changes. There's no way to tick to be the winner on all of those factors. The way this court's opinion was set up, the direction was set up, was make the least change and don't screw it up in some other way. Right? So applying those criteria, right, making the least change and then not violating any other law, the court should adopt the governor's or Senator Buley's maps for the Assembly and Senate districts. You've already made the hard decision, setting the criteria. The decision now is which map to choose. If the governor's map is not your choice, and of course the governor's map not only wins on population movement and core retention, but I believe, as Attorney Devaney pointed out, another thing to pay attention to when you're talking about least change is geographical changes, right? And he pointed to this as a key consideration. Governor Evers' map also scores best among all the maps in geographical core retention. That addresses Justice Ziegler's concern about communities of interests, right? His map doesn't move the lines into far reaches in order to correct a problem.
Do you think that moving Senator Lena Taylor's district into Waukesha County and Ozaukee County preserves community of interest?
I think that the important aspect with that, and I am not a voting rights expert, but I think the important aspect on that particular district is that it was overly packed, and it is correcting a packing problem.
And core retention is one part of the analysis, but you look at the underpinning. What underlies how they got that number? And when it involves splitting local communities and involves a population deviation that might be troublesome in both of those areas, the core retention number becomes more suspect, right?
A core retention number becomes suspect in regional analyses, yes. And there are explanations for those kinds of changes in the governor's map, but there are not explanations for those kinds of changes when we look at the legislature's map. For instance, as an example where the Republicans move an astounding number, far more than is necessary to achieve quality, take a look at Assembly Districts 28, 29, and 30, which are Senate District 10 in the Hudson area. There, 5,000 voters needed to be moved out to achieve population equality, but the Republican legislators moved in and out of those districts over 90,000 voters. The same thing happened in AD 43 through 45, which is Senate District 15, which is on the Illinois border just south of Madison. To get perfect population equality, we needed to add about 2,800 votes. The Republicans moved in and out nearly 85,000 voters. These details are in the Cleland report filed on December 30th in tables 12 and 13. So there's no discernible reason for these massive movements of voters, none tied to nonpartisan constitutional or voting rights standards at any rate. The legislators' map does not reflect a least change approach, and it must be rejected. And I have got my stoplight on.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Attorney Pollan.
Chief Justice Ziegler, may we refer to one of our boards? This is a demonstrative.
That's the same that no one had an objection to.
That's
right?
Correct, Your Honor. We put it
Perfect.
Up this morning.
Thank you. There are three points
that I would like to address in rebuttal. The first, I would like to address some points that were made by Attorney Hirsch a little earlier. He essentially accused the Bloc petitioners of manufacturing a number of districts, and that they did it organically through an algorithm that they used. With the assistance of my colleague, Attorney Barnes, I'd like to point out why the changes that we made to comply with the VRA are organic, absolutely organic. First of all, I mentioned these this morning. In the current plan, which is on the left of the board in front of you, Milwaukee wards, just up a little bit more, Attorney Barnes, where it's in brown. Those are two wards in Milwaukee, wards 33 and 34. Those are majority Bloc wards. They're currently cracked into a predominantly white assembly district that's mostly located in Waukesha. If you look then over on the right in our proposal, what we did was we brought those into an existing Bloc opportunity district. That's all we did. That's an organic change because of the population changes in Milwaukee County. So that's an organic change. The other change that we made was up in Brown Deer. Currently, and it's up a little bit higher, Attorney Barnes, it's directly adjacent, just above current Assembly District 12 and where 11 is as well. So that's the northern part of Milwaukee and Brown Deer, just up a little bit more to the left. There we go. And that's a Bloc population as well. Because, again, of the changes in Milwaukee County in the Bloc and the white populations, we were able to bring that then into District 11 over on the right. These are organic changes that we made because of the population changes, and we were able to create those districts. Second of all, in terms of the performance analysis that we performed, you heard Attorney Hirsch talk about the fact that his expert used one method, ecological inference. Our expert used that same, but also used five additional methodologies just to double-check on the performance analysis. The racially polarized voting analysis. We used six different methodologies across every race, and we looked at racially polarized voting. So we actually did quite a bit more than they did in that analysis. We didn't just use one. We also would dispute that the citizen math scientist districts actually perform. This is in our expert report, Dr. Collingwood. Two of their districts actually in the Malin Mitchell race, they only give 34.5% of the vote for Mr. Mitchell in District 10 and 37.4 in District 12. So we dispute that they have districts that perform. I think the court is just going to have to take a look at the expert reports and are going to have to resolve that difference between the two.
Counsel, I have a question. Could you give me a very, very brief history of the application of the Voting Rights Act to the Bloc population in Milwaukee? How long has that been understood to exist? Was that true in 2011? Was it explicitly noted then or in prior maps with federal courts? Do you have any idea? Your other counsel might as well.
Yeah, Your Honor, I unfortunately don't. I do believe that it goes back at least a couple of decades. I would ask Attorney May over here because he was involved a couple of decades ago in that. But I know that it's been at least a couple of decades where there have either been five districts and then six districts. I just don't know when those changes occurred.
The legal standard from Cooper versus Harris that I understand when I think about it, and this isn't a Voting Rights Act challenge, so we don't have the same sort of, trial and burden of proof and those sorts of things. I think the standard, as I understand it, again, correct me if I'm wrong here, is that we're supposed to look whether there's good reason to think the Voting Rights Act might apply, and therefore apply maybe such a way that it can be carried out in the way you're saying it must be, or others as well. Is that right? Is that your understanding of Cooper versus Harris, that we look to whether there's a good reason to think the Voting Rights Act might apply, and then we're kind of in VRA world, and then we get to some of these other questions? I just want to make sure I have my analytical categories correct.
Well, I think, Your Honor, that there was I think that Mr. Devaney answered this a little bit early on this morning. The question is, in the apportionment context, the question is, can you create an additional district? That really is what the court was looking at in various cases, like Bartlett versus Strickland.
Is there a good reason for us to create, good reason to think that an additional district should be created?
That's exactly right, Your Honor, and that's where the Jingles test comes in. And if the Jingles test is satisfied, then there's reason to create an additional district. Justice Kennedy, in fact, wrote in Bartlett versus Strickland, the special significance in the democratic process of a majority means that it is a special wrong when a minority group has 50% or more of the voting population and could constitute a compact voting majority, but despite racially polarized block voting, that group is not put into a district. And that's 556 U.S. 1 at page 19.
You know, the most relevant statistics to that point, just on the creation of the 7th District and that being mandatory in your view, or at the very least, there's good reason to think, that the VRA might require it, looking at the overall statewide population says the number should be between 6 and 7, as some of the folks have said, or maybe 7. And then you looked at the increase of the black voting age population in Milwaukee and the relative decrease of the black voting age population of Milwaukee County in that area. Are those the relevant statistics? Are there others? Am I right on that?
Well, the relevant statistics, Your Honor, it's the three Jingles prong, the three Jingles factors that we analyzed. I mean, it certainly is those things. I don't mean to say that it's not. Yeah. But then we went through the analysis and we looked to see whether the Jingles factors were satisfied and also the totality of the circumstances satisfied. And the expert evidence that we put into the record says that it is.
I have a hard time understanding again how to do why the analysis would look different whether there's 6 or 7 districts. Right, based on if you have 6 districts under the existing standards, whether the three Jingles factors are preconditions are satisfied, totality of the circumstances, it feels to me like either the Voting Rights Act applies in the city of Milwaukee to the black population in this relatively compressed area, right where I grew up, or not. So whether that says the metrics or other, the first precondition says you can make another district.
Yeah, the question is how many districts can be made? And this is not a question of maximization, Your Honor, because we could have drawn more. We could have drawn 8 or we could have drawn 9, but we didn't. We drew 7, and we drew 7 because that's what the statistics show can be drawn. Racially polarized voting is present. The totality of the circumstances are met. And so that additional district gets added under the Supreme Court's precedent. If I could, there were two other points I quickly would like to make. First of all, with respect to the legislature's assembly districts, Dr. Alford is the legislature's expert on racially polarized voting. He says in his original report that the Malin Mitchell versus Tony Evers 2018 gubernatorial primary was a relevant race to use for analyzing performance. And he says that on page 4 to 6 of his report. But Dr. Alford made a mistake, actually, in his calculations. And Dr. Collingwood, our expert, pointed that out in his rebuttal report, second report. And what he showed, actually, Dr. Alford agreed with this, was that Malin Mitchell would only have received 39.3% in the legislature's Assembly District 10. He wouldn't have carried that district. And Dr. Alford does concede this, and therefore they wouldn't be able to carry that district. The last point, they don't have six effective districts. The last point that I would like to make is one quick point on population deviation, because I don't believe that I've spoken to that today at all. And very quickly, a point of perspective. The difference actually in population deviation between the block petitioner's assembly plan and the legislature's assembly plan is 1.32%. That's our population deviation. The legislature's is 0.76%. The difference there equates to about 3,200 people statewide. In a state of 5.6 million people, that means 3,200 people. That's about the size of some wards in the city of Milwaukee and some wards in the city of Madison. That's what we're talking about here in these differences of population. And so in terms of population equality, we don't believe that exactness is required in terms of being as low as possible. We do think that there is a 2% limit on what can be done. But we think that the entire line of cases that talk about, as Justice Hagedorn had pointed out earlier, the Cunningham case from 1892, they're talking about population deviations of 180%. And that's what's being addressed in the Zimmerman case in 1964 as well. And so it's one thing to say there's no way you can justify those kinds of population deviations and these incredibly small differences that amount to one ward across the entire state. They really are meaningless. They're de minimis and meaningless. Unless the justices have any other questions, I'm finished.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I think what we should do is take just a, I'm going to say 5 minutes because I know it'll be 10 minutes. Break and just try to come back out around a quarter after three, let people stretch their legs and just drink the water or something and then come back at it, okay? Have a seat. Back on the record. Next up is Attorney Meehan. There you are, poised and ready to go. All right, 10 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to make two main points in my rebuttal. First, what does it mean for a plan to be a lease changes plan? And second, how can the court most easily and most correctly frame the VRA and equal protection questions here? And I'd like to close not with my words, but with the words of Wisconsin's existing representatives in VRA districts. First, lease changes. Contrary to the counsel for the governor's argument, there is not agreement that the governor's plan is the lease changes plan for the assembly and Senate maps. Core retention is an aspect of lease changes. It is not the only factor to consider. We have talked about those other factors in our briefs, and I will leave our argument there for that, but I do want to address, Justice Hagedorn, your questions about how municipal splits and how population equality fit in. Those are also factors to be considered for lease changes. When a plan creates a new municipal split, that is a literal change from existing law. Existing law literally says the whole county of Polk or the whole county of this or the whole city of that should be in a district. And when a plan splits the county, splits the town, that is a change. It is undisputed that the legislature's plan makes the fewest changes on this metric. We split 14 new municipal splits as a change from existing law if you count pre-existing splits where municipalities cross county lines. The governor splits more than 50 new municipalities that didn't exist before. Block splits more than 30 new municipalities which didn't exist before. If you want a great example of this, look at Oconomowoc. It was previously in District 38. Under the governor's plan, it has now been split between District 24, District 97, and District 98. Similarly, population deviation can also reflect a change. If population deviation is greater than that in the existing map, that is a departure from the public policy of the acceptable amount of vote dilution. Again, our map matches existing population deviation. The governor's doubles it. Second, what is the framework for the Voting Rights Act and the equal protection questions here? First, just to start, everyone agrees that the Constitution forbids race-based redistricting. The Constitution forbids race-based targets. The VRA is an exception, of course, to that constitutional prohibition. But it is not an exception at all times in all places. And so the question here is whether the VRA's exception applies, which means whether the VRA requires a race-based change to the legislature's race-neutral plan. It does not. So that raises two subsidiary questions. Do the legislature's six districts comply with the VRA? They do, and nothing that has been said here today changes that.
So I'm confused because you said the VRA doesn't apply, and if it doesn't apply, why do you need to argue to us that the six meet the VRA? I don't understand.
We have assumed that the VRA applies in the Milwaukee districts.
Right.
Our expert in his reply report suggested that if anyone wanted to litigate that question, there could be arguments on both sides. The question is not whether the VRA applies. The question is what the VRA requires. The VRA requires that the legislature's districts be lawful. The VRA requires that everyone else's districts be lawful. That doesn't just mean maximizing districts. It means they comply with the VRA. They also comply with the United States Constitution. Our expert has done a VRA analysis in both his opening report and in his reply report. He explains that the legislature's existing six districts are lawful. They are proportionate to the number of black voting age Wisconsinites, and nothing about today changes that. And to be very clear, Dr. Collingwood and Dr. Alford agree that our District 10 performs with real election numbers. Dr. Collingwood does not dispute that in our District 10, in the gubernatorial primary, black voters would elect their candidate of choice by a sweeping plurality. Everyone agrees on that score. There is no factual, there is no disagreement based on the real election results.
Can we just sorry, go back to your first point, which is that any change is a change and you change things the least, which is what I'm understanding you to argue. So, because that's not what you argued in the first brief that you submitted to us. In the first brief you submitted to us, you argued core retention and that the fact that you you talked about voter dilution in the state Senate elections, and then you talked about continuity of representation and incumbent pairings.
Yep.
You didn't argue at that time that you changed municipal boundaries the least or districts, municipal boundaries the least, therefore you win the race to least change.
If you read on in our brief, we did say that increased municipal splits do effectuate a departure from existing law. And I just want to emphasize, the existing law literally says this is split, this is not. And so when you split something new, it is split. Another, we did argue that. And yes, we do believe our plan is the least changes plan when you consider not only a 1.6 difference in assembly core retention, but you also evaluate Senate core retention. You also evaluate Senate disenfranchisement, which we beat the governor and block on. When you also evaluate incumbent pairings, which we match or beat the governor and block on. And when you also evaluate municipal splits, population deviations, and any other marker of change from existing law.
Right. Any other marker except the number of people who you have moved from one district to another.
No, Your Honor, we fully agree we are second best when it comes to that in the Assembly. We absolutely disagree that we are any better than any worse than the best when it comes to the Senate. We move the fewest number of people in the Senate. But again, it is not merely a 1.6% difference. That would be completely arbitrary. You have to take account of the other factors. And I don't want to sit down before I get to the second VRA point, which is if the VRA does not require seven districts, then what the governor and Block have proposed is unconstitutional. And that is a simple question for this court. The Supreme Court has made it so, and please read DeGrande. DeGrande assumes that Jingles is met. It even assumes the totality of the circumstances is met. And it says you cannot define dilution. You cannot make a VRA violation out of the failure to maximize. Here today, we've heard over and over, you can draw seven districts, so you must. That is what was rejected in DeGrande. It was rejected in Miller versus Johnson. Finally, don't take my word for it. Take the real-world consequences of their plans. Take the words and the votes of the existing VRA representatives in the districts that the governor's plan and Block's plan dismantle. Nearly 50% of the existing voters in those northern Milwaukee districts are moved out. Their relationship with their candidate of choice is severed. They are replaced by tens of thousands of voters in Mequon and in Menominee Falls. The existing representatives in Milwaukee's predominantly Black districts have already rejected and denounced that dismantling. In the words of one of those representatives, there is no way that people who live at the lake in Milwaukee's 53206 zip code, in Good Hope Road, and at Ernie von Schlaedorn in Menominee Falls have all the same interests. She asked rhetorically, why do that? Why make the changes you saw earlier in Block's plan? It goes across the county line. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense at all. That's not going to stick. We agree. The maps are at best, they at best impose drastic and unnecessary changes in violation of this court's order. At worst, they are unconstitutional, motivated by a completely specious understanding of the VRA. If there are no further questions, I'll yield the remainder of my time.
All right, thank you. Attorney Ruth Smalley.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I would like to make three points about the congressional maps and then move to Assembly, if I may. First, something not talked about much in the Congressman's argument is that everyone agrees that the governor's map makes the least changes. If you look at the map, or if you look at the statistics, governor's map moves fewer people. If you look at the geographical, just the space, the districts cover. This is in page 10, I believe, table 1 of the Hunter response brief. The governor's map retains 98.5% compared to 90.6% of the congressman's map. The governor's map is much closer geographically. Now, if you use those transparencies the court asked for and you put the maps on top of each other, the part of the map that the congressmen are asking you to look at, compare that to the old map, it's very close. Actually, the biggest change you'll see is that Waukesha was county was united. That was united, and that's then the biggest change you'll see if you kind of put those maps on top of each other. So they're very close geographically.
So what are the reasons?
I can jump to that, Your Honor. I'd like to first point out that a lot of the things that were said in that argument were things like, makes sense, what the court likes. These are not the kinds of things we understand the court's November 30th order to allow the parties to win or lose on. Those are the kind of things, those are policy calls, those are judgment calls in the eye of the beholder. So we don't think that is a legal requirement, and nothing that was talked about in that, almost nothing that was talked about was actually like, this is required by law. They were all things saying, this is a good idea. So none of those things are legal necessities. But I'll give you the reasons anyway, because they've been raised so prominently by counsel. So we were talking about District 2, which is 50,000 people over, more or less. And what the congressman did was move that west into District 3, which was only underpopulated by a few thousand. They moved that overpopulation west, and that was not necessary or does not make sense. They didn't need to move that population west. Where the underpopulation was that matches that is to the east. District 1 and District 4 were underpopulated about 50,000, about the same amount that District 2 was overpopulated. The governor moved that population to the east. And the changes you see, and, you know, we could talk about this all week, little line changes. The changes you see, a lot of those changes in those districts are a result of moving the overpopulation in 2 to the east. And then there's changes in the districts in between. And I'll tell you about a few choices that they made making the maps. One I just mentioned and maybe came up earlier, they united Waukesha County. Now it's all in one congressional district. Before it was split like 60-40. So united a county, something the parties have talked about as being a virtue. So there's one united Beloit. It united Jefferson County, which causes a split of Whitewater. And that goes to show you have to make trade-offs. You could have kept Whitewater together and split Jefferson County, or you could go the other way. Which is the right answer? There isn't the right answer. There's no way to judge that, but that's as a choice that was made. District 4 needed population, so cities adjacent to it were added to it. So Wauwatosa and some of West Allis are right next to Milwaukee. That's part of District 4. Other people might make different choices, but those cities are in that community, in that area. Beloit and Janesville are now in the same district. They're major cities in the same county. They cooperate for various purposes. They weren't in the same district before. Beloit and Janesville are now united in the same district. And, you know, you could go on and on, but as you can see, there's all kinds of explanations you can give. If the question before the court was, what feels good? But that's not the question. The court made clear that the question before the court was, make the least changes unless legally necessary to do otherwise. So that's what we talked about in our brief.
Was it possible for the governor to draw a congressional map that had a range of 1, the deviation?
So just to be precise with what we're arguing, Your Honor, the governor's map, in our view, does have a deviation of 1, just 1 up and 1 down.
He did that dance the last time we talked, okay? And you used range, and that's fine. I get what you're saying. My question is, was it possible to have a range of 1?
Yes. Well, it's possible.
Okay, and other people did that, correct?
Right.
And what was the reason the governor did not?
Because the governor's understanding was you can't draw a perfect district, right? Everyone agrees with that. And so you should be within 1 of perfect. Every district in the map is within 1 of perfect. That was the reasoning. There's nothing more to it.
Really?
And does
that cause yourself a lot of trouble if that's the
that
only reason?
Like that apparently, Your Honor.
Can I just ask, and why, and just from a legal perspective, why does that make sense? Like, why within 1?
Because you can't draw perfect. So then you go as close as you can get with this within 1. And I'd like to, there are a couple cases thrown out. I want to throw out one just in response. The Tennant v. Jefferson County case, this is U.S. Supreme Court, 567 U.S. 758 at 759. It's from 2012. And it says, the Constitution does not require congressional districts to be drawn with precise mathematical equality. Rather, it requires a good faith effort to achieve absolute equality. A good faith effort. No one's
pointing. But was that done here? Because in Mahan versus Howell, the United States Supreme Court said there is no excuse for the failure to meet the objective of equal representation for equal numbers of people. And I know you've quibbled about whether it's one or two, but when we look at the deviation, there are some districts that are above ideal by one person. Mm-hmm. There's other districts that are below the ideal by one person. So the total deviation, as it has been calculated in many cases, it would make that a two. So I guess my question for you, and I think it was what Justice Rogenczak was also asking, is what is the excuse for the failure to meet that objective of equal representation?
We don't believe it is a requirement to be just one above or one below. The difference is 0.000 and eventually you get to a number. Not constitutionally required, and no party has pointed to a case anywhere. You didn't hear a case anywhere that requires you to be all above or all below by one. It just isn't out there. And no one could bring a claim, go to court and win a claim like that. That's not cognizable and justiciable, to use this court's language in its November 30th opinion.
Can you think of any case or any time where one plus one doesn't equal two? I mean, it's always equaled two in anything I've looked at. So your interpretation is kind of a new way to look at it, and you may be right, but it isn't something I've seen with support in the law. So any law that supports your math?
That is a good faith effort. It's the only thing what I've said, Your Honor, is a good faith effort to be within one of the ideal, up or down. And we're aware of no case anywhere suggesting that's illegal.
What about Karcher? There are no de minimis population variations which could practicably be avoided, but which nonetheless meet the standard of Article 1, Section 2, without justification.
Again, Your Honor, we believe we've met that by being within one. Every district is in one of the ideal. I'd like to make a few quick points on the assembly. Again, we've satisfied least changes no matter how you measure it. It's core retention. If you look at geographical retention, if you look at district by district, all of those show least changes. And this court did define least changes, at least to a certain extent. It said it referred to making the minimum changes to current district boundaries. That is said more than once in this court's decision. Current district boundaries, I believe it's 85 and 87 in the opinion. It's not just some vague notion, and everyone understood that in the opening briefs. We're talking about the actual boundaries and the people in them. That's what we're talking about, and whether you're moving them. On splits, I think there was some talking past each other on that. The current map from 2011, right now, if you analyze it, has 126 splits. The splits are created because municipalities grew. The governor's map goes down from that. So there's 126 splits just day one, no one touching the map. So that's where that number's coming from.
What are your numbers on splits? Because I thought we went through that before, and they are a lot higher than the legislature's.
Of their current proposal, that's correct. And I was just clarifying. They said we went up 50, when in fact we went, if you look at the current map based on existing boundaries right now, we actually went down. It's only if you measure the old districts, 10 years ago, that's my fault being gesticulating so much, so you have to look back 10 years to get that number. But if you start right now from the current district boundaries, as this court instructed, you get 126 splits. So I just wanted to make sure that I think there was just a bit of talking past each other on that. Lastly, I don't think I ever got to the point that also in our Constitution there is a compactness requirement for assembly districts, and the governor's map does the best on compactness. It does better than the legislature on that constitutional requirement. And because we're talking about least changes and that being better, that seems like maybe it's not as important to the argument. But if you're looking at other factors, that certainly is in the Constitution, and that certainly is a requirement. And the governor's map, while making least changes, also is more compact. Districts hold together in a more compact way. And lastly, I believe I'm probably about out of time. I just want to make clear that this one person, one vote issue has been addressed recently by the court. In the November 30th opinion, the court said on paragraph 26, equal protection as applied to state legislative districts imposes a less exacting one person, one vote principle. Less exacting. Paragraph 33, may I finish my sentence?
Yes.
That the state requirement is consistent with the federal counterpart And paragraph 81, again, this court is only here to remedy justiciable and cognizable rights. So we think this court actually did address the issue. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, Attorney Devaney.
Good afternoon, Justices. I have a few relatively brief points to make in response to arguments from the legislature, the congressman, and the Johnson petitioners. And beginning with the legislature, they have argued that deviations from the lease change were necessary to maximize compliance with traditional redistricting criteria. And as I mentioned earlier, we expressly requested that those criteria be prioritized. We didn't prevail on that. But just as the legislature has failed to do best on the metric it originally requested and that this court ordered, lease change, they have also failed to do best on their new emphasis of emphasizing traditional criteria. In particular, the Constitution mentions that adherence to counties, towns, and precincts, and this court's November 30th order suggested the smallest units, that is precincts, should be used to preserve. Now, the block assembly map does better than the legislature's on lease change, and it did better or does better than the legislature's map on precinct splits. And also, as Councilman the Governor just pointed out, the legislature hasn't talked about compactness at all, but that too is a requirement in the Constitution. And the governor's assembly map, as demonstrated by our expert, does better than the legislature's on lease changes, and it does better on compactness. The court did not tell us to maximize on splits or compactness, but even if you had, it would lead you to the same maps as lease changes lead you to, or blocks in the governor's maps. Turning to congressional, the congressman's map performs lowest on core retention among all four maps, 92.1% versus 96.5% for the governor and 95.1% for our map, the Hunter map. And the congressman's map also performs lowest on political division splits, which is an average of political boundary splits of counties, municipalities, and precincts. And that's set forth also in our response brief. Now, it was striking that counsel for the congressman said in response to questions about CDs 2, 3, and 7 that our congressmen don't run in those districts. You know, so we're not that concerned about them. And if you want to make changes to them, go ahead. That's not how this should be approached. They approach their map based on the political interests of their clients, the congressmen who are running for office and who they're representing. And so it was said, if you have problems with CD2 or CD3, go ahead and make changes. We don't have any skin in the game. But that's not how Wisconsinites would want a map to be adopted. A map adopted only based on having been drawn for congressmen who are clients and who had skin in this game. Everybody has skin in this game. Everybody, every district and every citizen of this state. And perhaps that's why we see what the congressman did in CD3, where, as was discussed, they moved 238,929 people in and out of the district, even though the district was unpopulated by just 3,131 people. An additional point that I want to make about that is there were multiple districts surrounding District 3 that were also underpopulated. It would have been very easy and more consistent with lease change to have moved people into those districts from CD3 rather than moving 240,000 approximately people. That's not consistent with the lease change approach. And let's not forget also about what the congressman did in CD7. There, the district is underpopulated by 4,133 people, and yet the congressman moved approximately 156,000 people in and out of CD7. You combine just those two districts, you end up with just under 400,000 people with the congressman maps, the map moves. Now, the congressmen were under no duty to propose a failed legislative bill. They could have submitted a map that does better on lease change, but they chose not to, and there is no time for a substantive redo, as has been suggested and as this court has ordered. Now, when this court ordered lease change, every party understood that to mean core retention. It's what the Johnson petitioners, the legislature, and the congressmen requested, and it's how they defended their initial submissions to the court. And it's only after everyone put their cards on the table with their maps that the arguments began to change, and a focus began on lease deviation, fewer splits, and in some cases, the largest, longest narrative explanation for changes in a map. Now, as for the Johnson petitioners, they claim that population equality should be the primary factor. They previously urged the court to adopt maps making minimum changes necessary to ensure their constitutionality. That's what they're opening. And they define least change as meaning the fewest number of people moved to new districts. As they must, they don't contest the governor's legislative maps move the fewest people. And faced with that, they revert to population equality. I know that there's been population equality discussion ad nauseum. I will not beat it into the ground other than to say there is no case that requires or creates a cognizable action or right with respect to deviation by one or two in the congressional map. And there also is no case that says that something less than 2%, which all the legislative maps, I believe, accomplish, is not consistent with the law. And with that, I ask if there are any questions. If not, I'll take my seat.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any Hirsch?
Your Honors, thank you again for your amazing patience today. Greatly appreciated. I want to make 5 points. Hopefully I can do it in less than 10 minutes. Number one, the U.S. Supreme Court in Chapman versus Meyer, Connor versus Finch, and Abrams versus Johnson said that when courts are saddled with the unwelcome obligation of redistricting in the place of a legislature and governor, then they must hold themselves to higher or stricter standards, especially on population equality, and that to do otherwise, this is from Connor at page 415, injects a taint of arbitrariness into the process. Second point, 20 years ago, after failing to convince a Pennsylvania state court that perfect population equality was required in their congressional map, an 18-district map, I went to federal court in the Middle District of Pennsylvania and got that map invalidated for an 18-person deviation across 18 districts. Ever since, a majority of states have abided by the rule of one-person deviation. It may or may not be an absolute legal mandate, but if you're trying to avoid the risk of this court's map getting attacked in federal court, going with a one-person deviation is the way to go. Third point, how does that compare to the population equality standard under Article 4, Section 3 of the Wisconsin Constitution? This question was answered by the Attorney General of Wisconsin in a 1969 official formal opinion. The Attorney General said there is no distinction between the federal standard I just described for congressional districts and the state constitutional standard for state legislative districts. My understanding of paragraph 33 of your November 30th order, where you said that Article 4, Section 3's population equality requirement is, quote, consistent with its federal counterpart, echoed that 1969 Attorney General's opinion. And furthermore, in the omnibus amended petition that virtually all the parties agreed to in paragraph 83, we all said the same thing. Fourth point, let's look at the three maps. As to the Senate map, the citizen mathematicians and scientists map is best or tied for best on population equality, county integrity, ward integrity, the REOC measure of compactness, the Voting Rights Act, and the only quantitative measure of communities of interest in the record, and second, on the Polsby-Popper convex hull and cut edges measures of compactness. We are the only Senate map that keeps Winnebago County whole, the only one that keeps Kenosha County whole, the only one that keeps Dodge County whole, and the same for the cities of Racine and West Allis. And 77% of our boundaries track exactly inch for inch the 2011 plan or a county line. On the assembly map, we are best or tied for best in population equality, county integrity, ward integrity, the Voting Rights Act, and that quantitative measure of communities of interest. And we are also first or second on all four compactness measures, only behind sometimes the Hunter map, which I believe they've withdrawn. And as to Congress, this is where we really crush the competition. We are number one or tied for number one in population equality, county integrity, town integrity, municipal, meaning city, village, or town integrity, ward integrity, the Polsby-Popper compactness measure, the REOC compactness measure, the cut edges compactness measure, Voting Rights Act compliance, the one quantitative measure of communities of interest. And we are better than the legislature's map on four out of five of the least change measures in the record. And we follow inch for inch the 2011 boundaries or county lines for 88% of our boundaries.
Mr. Hirsch, Mr. Saitlin said that, made the argument that you have not put forth in this record as to why you made the decisions in your congressional map that you made. Is it the list that you just gave us, or are there other reasons?
It is mostly the list we just gave us, but we were attacked, I believe, during that argument for District 4, and I pulled it out to take a look at it. And we follow exactly the Milwaukee County, Waukesha County line up until you get to the northwest corner of Milwaukee County. Then we follow the Ozaukee County, Milwaukee County line the whole way to the lake. Then we follow the lakefront. And then by my eye, at least, it looked like we hugged the southern edge of the city of Milwaukee city limit. And then we do slice through Greenfield because we have to get the perfect population equality, but it's almost a dead even east-west line. It's a beautifully compact district that's highly respectful of political subdivisions. So if that's the worst thing that they can say from our lack of district-by-district justification, I'll take it. I didn't find it very compelling. The bottom line is in all three maps, we are best or tied for best on three of the most important things. Population equality, where we are better than anyone on the Senate map, anyone on the Assembly map, and tied only with the legislature as to the congressional map, but ahead of them on population equality as to both Senate and Assembly. We are the best on wards because we break none of them in the Senate map, none of them in the Assembly map, and only eight of them, far less than the legislature or anybody else, in the congressional map. And we are easily best on counties in all three maps, whether you're looking at the number of counties split or the number of pieces into which they are split. So last, I want to talk about the role of this court.
Counsel, before you get to that, when I was preparing for this, and I recall having a feeling in reading your brief that you had, and I used the word in my notes, disdain for the least change approach. Could you, that's my word, not yours. Right?
Yes, Your Honor.
That was my impression that I had.
No, we argued for a version of least change in the October 25th and November 1st briefs. And then when this court came out with its order on November 30th, we have fully accepted it and we've tuned our algorithms to match it as best we can. So I don't think that's correct.
Okay.
As to the role of this court, let me close by saying this. Fairly or unfairly, if you adopt the maps passed by the legislature but vetoed by the governor, others will say that you, in effect, overrode the veto for a legislative majority that did not have the supermajority necessary to do that under the Constitution. Conversely, if you adopt the map proposed by the governor or the similar ones proposed by the governor's allies up here, they're going to say you've ignored the role of the legislature, which is preeminent in redistricting. These may be totally unfair attacks, but you have a way around this. You have in front of you a set of maps that are the best on the objective metrics that follow your November 30th order to a T, and that come from a nonpartisan group of professors who are not here fighting for their own political power or voting strength. I implore you, choose these maps. It's the best thing for the state of Wisconsin and for the people of Wisconsin, and they will forever respect you for that decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Attorney Staton.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'll respond to the governor, the Hunter petitioners, and the citizen mathematicians, and then say a word about lease changes.
That's a fine plan, except I have something else in mind for you.
I will do none of those things.
You started out with your argument before, saying that each of the other three congressional plans are unconstitutional. I want you to begin by telling me how each of the other three plans are unconstitutional.
Your Honor, only two of the other three plans are unconstitutional.
Okay, well then tell me about those two.
The governor's plan and the Hunter petitioner's plan move more than the minimum number of people without justification. Have a greater population deviation than one without justification. That is contrary to U.S. Supreme Court law. The case that my friend quoted said there had to be a good faith effort to achieve exact population equality between districts in Congress. And the way the courts have operationalized that is that the only way you're ever allowed to go beyond the one person difference is if you give an explanation that you couldn't have done it any other way. That's what good faith effort means. They gave this court no explanation why they departed by two.
And tell me the case that says they have to say that they couldn't have done it any other way. I've never read that, so I would be very interested in that.
That is the Karcher case without justification. That's what that means.
But that's what that means to you, couldn't have done it any other way? What
yes, about, that has to be.
Doesn't justification mean have a reason? It doesn't mean couldn't have done it any other way.
However Your Honor wants to pose it, they gave no justification. So if you... Regardless, and Your Honor, that was going to be part of my answer to the governors and the Hunter. Now, with the governor, I was on the edge of my seat. I thought for the first time in this litigation, I was finally going to get an explanation of why they moved sizable communities out of District 4, hugely underpopulated, into District 1. Not a word. That was the so on and on at the end of that the governor's council trained off. Because there is no justification for that. There's no justification that they're willing to say in a court of law. With regard to the citizen mathematicians, they make that same move. Again, no justification. This is entirely egregious.
Mr. Staton, I'm not understanding what you're saying, because Mr. Russomanno said they added districts to the congressional maps. They moved because there was an overpopulation here in District 2, mm-hmm. So they moved east towards Milwaukee. They united Waukesha County. They united Beloit in the first CD. They united Jefferson County, but split Whitewater, and he conceded. You got to make some choices. That was a choice they made. District 4 needed population, so they added Wauwatosa and West Allis. I think, again, he said, could you have made different choices there? Yeah, you could have, but that was the choice that they made. They had to make some choice in drawing those lines.
Your Honor, if you take nothing else from what I said, there's a reason that he stopped explaining there. The first objection I made, and the one I hammered on over and over again, is why pull those sizable communities out of four into one? And I would urge Your Honor to go watch the recording on Wisconsin Eye after this. He did not say a word, not a word that would justify that change, because there is no possible justification for depopulating even further the most depopulated district and pulling those people into District 1 when District 1 already abuts District 2 and population equality can change that way. Yes, Your Honor.
If you are starting with District 2, which has too many people in it, and you're going to move east, you're bumping into 1. You can't just move people from the second CD into the fourth because there's CDs in between them.
Your Honor, this is what happened. We don't have enough time to hash it out here. This is what happened. They gratuitously, without explanation, moved people out of 4 into 1, which means they had to move more people out of 5 into 4 than they otherwise would have. That change, that very significant change from the most moving people from the most depopulated district to a different district is without explanation in the briefs, without explanation here, the citizen mathematicians make the exact same move. And again, no explanation. And I would just ask Your Honor to take a look at that after the oral argument. Now, with regard to the Hunter folks, a counsel for Hunter said, well, it's too late now. Everyone's already submitted their maps. Well, fair enough. Their map is unconstitutional. The governor's map is unconstitutional. Our map is constitutional. The only one that moves a reasonable number of people explains every single change.
Counsel, I want to address the comments made by some of the parties that the playing field seems to be changing from least change directive to population equality. And the congressmen are taken to task by the mathematicians and scientists, which means we have trouble right here at the state capitol. And in page 5, this is of the response brief, and they're deriding a number of parties for saying, oh, least change is preeminent. And it indicates on the top of 5, most parties, however, privilege least change over nearly all considerations. Then they target you. For example, the congressman expressly claims that when evaluating a proposed remedial map, this court should first consider whether the map follows a, quote, least change approach. The derision is, there's some equality in it, and the governor repeatedly asserts that compliance with least change is the court's, quote, primary concern. Then the scientists and mathematicians go on to kind of spread a broader charge. Many of the parties treat the Constitution's express requirements only as tiebreakers when deciding where to shift lines that must be moved to population changes. So is that a correct characterization of at least you? You can speak for the congressman, that that was at least your initial position? Or are the math and science folks misrepresenting you, as they state on the what they did on top of page 5.
Your Honor, to the extent they're talking about us, they're certainly misrepresenting us. We have been consistent entirely with what these changes mean. Core retention, that is, people moved, not trees and acres, is an important consideration. But the overarching inquiry is, as every single change in the map in service of equalizing districts, what the governor does and what the Hunter people do, and what the citizen mathematicians do, is they attempt to bank, you know, what the changes from in other parts of the map to make completely gratuitous changes to destroy District 1 without any justification, without a justification in population equality, without a justification in communities of interest, and that is fundamentally contrary to this court's order. We explained every single change we made to the current districts to reach population equality. There's been some criticism between what we did in Districts 1 and District 7. I think that the map we submitted to Your Honors best complies with least changes on that line for the reasons that I have explained. But if the Honors disagree with that, Your Honors have an option to do something about that. We do.
Can I face, argue, 238,000 moving in District 3 when there's only about an underpopulation of 3,500 or 4,000? That that's the least change? I mean, I just find that difficult to mesh with reality.
Your Honor, I think we are going to have to respectfully disagree with each other on that, but I will again reiterate, if Your Honors do not like that one change, Your Honors have before you an option. If Your Honors think there is no more rounds to be had, there's no way that you guys just have to choose between the maps that have been presented, even if you think all of them are deficient, well, then you have to choose ours, because the governor is the only one that moves less people than us overall. His map is unconstitutional and makes numerous unexplained changes. The Hunter folks is also unconstitutional, and they move more people than us, also numerous unexplained changes. The citizen mathematicians have a constitutional map. They move far more people than us, and in addition, they make numerous unexplained changes, including the most egregious change that the governor makes, which is that completely inexplicable, at least in court, unexplained move of people from District 4, which is hugely underpopulated, to District 1. I'm not sure how much more I could have jumped up and down in the briefs or here to ask these parties to explain why District 4 is depopulated even further into District 1. The reason that they cannot explain to you, and the reason that council said, and so on, in explaining a bunch of other things, when this was my lead criticism, is because they have no answer that they're willing to give to this court. And since they are proposing this map, and they have no answer that they're willing to sign on before this court, that map is fundamentally illegitimate and must be rejected, even if it wasn't illegal, which it is.
All right, thank you very much. Well, lively day we've had here today. Thank you for coming and participating. Thank you for your good briefing, arguments, and I will be in touch with my colleagues about a meeting time, but we will adjourn for the day, and everyone drive safely and safe travels wherever you're heading. Thank you.